House, yeah. He, 2 o'clock, and I'm doing a house. Oh, nice. Thank you. Yeah, we got it.
Okay, we're going to bring the Senate Finance to order. I don't know how long we can go here, but we'll go as long as we can. We have a little recess from the floor, so we just thought we'd make good use of our time here and continue with our finance meeting. And so with us, we have Senator Olson, Senator Hoffman, Senator Dunleavy, Senator Bishop, and Vice Chair Fairclough. And this afternoon, we're going to take up only House Bill 4, Senate Bill 13, the Kinnick Arm Bridge, we will not take up today. So, and where we left off on House Bill 4, the In-State Gas Development Corporation, this is our fifth hearing on this subject, and last night we'd heard from Mr. Walker, and today we'd like to hear from the bill sponsor, Representative Chenault and Representative Hawker and or staff, and see if they have any additional comments to make, and then we'd like to hear from Mr. Richards as well as Mr. Dubler to kind of go over the financing a little bit. So with that, why don't I have the sponsors or Rena come up and just tell me where you'd like to go from here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee. For the record, I'm Rena Delbridge, staff to Representative Hawker. The sponsors appreciated an opportunity today to go over some of the things that you heard yesterday and explain what is actually in House Bill 4.
Yeah, Rena, if I may, I hate to interrupt, but we do have some special guests here today that we don't usually have. I don't know if Senator Dunleavy wants to tell us where these future legislators are that are visiting us today.
Through the chair, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee and others here, I'm honored to have my fellow Palmerites. We have folks here. We have youngsters and teachers and others from the Academy Charter in Palmer, Alaska, which is a very, very fine charter school. It's part of the Matanuska Borough School District. And it's my understanding that the folks make an annual trip to Juneau so that students can find out the inner workings of government and find out where the decisions are made on behalf of the state. So I would love to welcome, could I just ask the staff just to stand, please, and just so we can see who you are? Raise your hand if you're a teacher, a principal. Are there any other adults that are with the group, if they could stand? Are they parents? Are they beautiful? And then if they could the kids stand for me, please? Excellent. These are your future legislators, folks. These are the folks that are going to solve problems for Alaska. So thank you, kids, for coming. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for joining us today. Yeah. This bill, actually, that we're hearing and taking up right now is hopefully will have a very positive impact to your future in the sense that this could potentially be a good means to provide you with affordable energy in their future, so, and your school and your home. Okay, so Rena, I'm sorry. Anything else before we get started? Okay, Rena, please, Ms. Delbridge.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I may actually start by asking Frank Richards with AGDC to come up and join me and address some of the allegations yesterday about AGDC's cost estimates on this pipeline.
Okay, Mr. Richards.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Frank Richards with the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. Yesterday, Mr. Chairman, we heard some discussion about the cost estimate and the level of detail in the cost estimate and the validity of the cost estimate. So I wanted to at least give an update to the committee on how AGDC did their work in terms of developing a cost estimate. And it really goes back to the original premise within HB 369, which was a legislative action that created AGDC to be able to advance an in-state natural gas pipeline from natural gas from the North Slope to Fairbanks and to those in South Central. With that, we were charged to develop a project plan. That project plan meant that we had to initiate or continue on the environmental process, but also advance the engineering for not only the pipeline aspects, but the facility aspects of it. So with the funding and the direction by the legislature, we did just that. That means that we hired experts. We hired pipeline engineers. We hired process engineers. We hired mechanical engineering companies to be able to advance the project design and advance it to a point where we went from a concept, a thought, a hope, a dream, to one where you actually had details on paper, where you could actually come up with cost estimates of not only the pipe, the cost to excavate, the facilities, the process, the plant. So we used in our process what is methodology that is advanced by the Association for the Advancement of Cost Engineering, AACE, who sets out methodology for process engineering that is used industry-wide. It's used in the oil and gas industry, and it details levels of estimates based on the level of work. So with that, following the process of the AACE, we developed in the summer of 2011 for the project plan as mandated by the legislature a cost estimate for the project. At that time, the project concept was a lean gas case, and it was a 24-inch high-pressure pipeline. We came up with a cost estimate of $7.5 billion, plus or minus 30%. Again, the caveat was plus or minus 30% based on the level of engineering that we had at that time. In that estimate, there were contingencies. So that contingency is, again, another factor that is placed on the cost because we hadn't advanced the engineering far enough to be able to get to a point of we felt was total in cost estimate. For that, at that case, it was, I believe, about 30% for the facility or plant and about 5% for the pipeline. Subsequent to that work in 2011, in 2012, while the EIS was being completed and looking at the market conditions, we made a project plan update. That update shifted from a rich gas case to a lean gas case. At that time, we then revisited our costs. We looked at the process, again, using the methodology of AACE, and we actually increased our contingency for the pipeline from 5% to 10% and left the 30% contingency on the facilities, the gas conditioning facility and the compressors. That time, we came up with a cost estimate of approximately $7.7 billion. The reason that there was a slight increase, again, we reduced facilities, but we saw that there was inflation factors associated with that of approximately $200 million. We put forward this estimate in our revised project plan at the end of 2012. That project plan, again, shows a $7.7 billion cost estimate with the major features of the gas conditioning and compressor station, the pipeline route from the North Slope to Dunbar, a lateral to Fairbanks, and again from Dunbar down to Cook Inlet. That, Mr. Chairman, again, was done with industry practice and industry standards by engineering companies that are used not only by AGDC, but also by the oil and gas producers in this state. As the committee heard yesterday, we are using common engineering companies as our Alaska Pipeline, ConocoPhillips, ExxonMobil, and BP, that of Michael Baker, Price Gregory, and for us, Doran Emerald and Larkspur Associates. These are Alaskan-based companies that have experience on the North Slope and have done major process and pipeline work across their state for decades. So that, Mr. Chairman, was, again, an update on where we are in regards to the estimate. We are now at a Class 4 estimate based on that AACE methodology. And as we advance this work, we'll again refine the engineering to get us through to an open season where we'll actually be at a Class 3 estimate, again, based on the level of engineering that we will produce over the next year and a half.
Okay, very good. Ms. Delbridge?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, I'm sorry. We have a question. Senator Bishop.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Richards, as we're talking about these cost estimates, going forward, there's something that I think everybody in the state can agree on. We want to keep the price of this pipeline as close to the estimates as possible, correct?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, that's correct.
Because the closer that we come in to the price estimate, the lower the revenue, the toll and the tariff at the burner tip.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, that's correct. The lower your total install cost will mean a result in a lower tariff.
I had, in the In-State Energy Committee earlier in the year, the Commissioner of Department of Natural Resources talked about the global look on natural gas, looked at projects in Australia and Papua New Guinea and others, and talked about how some of these projects are doubling in price. My charge to you is I'd like to make sure that AGDC keeps all options open when they're looking going forward to executing contracts and take careful consideration into the use of multiple project labor agreements to keep this price under control so we can lock in those labor rates for the lengths and terms of this contract.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, again, moving forward, as you've said, the major factor for the tariff, the cost to consumers, will ultimately be that total installed cost for the project. AGDC will be working diligently to get through an open season, to advance to an open season, to identify to those potential shippers and buyers of the gas what the actual cost will be. We will use all available tools available to us to advance the project. And when you talk about labor cost of a project is going to be quite considerable. The material cost, the process and plant costs will be quite considerable. We need to use, again, all available tools to keep the cost at the lowest possible rate.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Sure, please.
To include looking at a project labor agreement, I would hope.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, we will look at project labor agreements as they become available. But again, as we move through an open season and we look towards an ownership model, we're going to want to be able to work with potential partners so that we have available to us then all those tools that are going to be best used by the project, including project labor agreements.
I might follow up, Mr. Chairman. Because the last thing we don't want it is to have a project come in twice the project estimate cost. I want gas for Alaskans more than anybody. And I just want to make sure that we don't limit ourselves and keep a tool out of the toolbox to come in under budget or on budget. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Any other questions for Mr. Richards? Okay, seeing none. Senator Olson, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Richards, yesterday we heard testimony by the other Mr. Richards and Bill Walker, and looked at the different stuff. And then after that, we had Bill Spots come on up and with some fairly pointed questioning, had some concerns they brought out and issues like that. And it was the lateness of the hour, and because of that, and I have to admit that I'm not that familiar with the situation since this isn't my area of expertise. But in trying to go ahead and understand things, I guess one of the things that I came to the conclusion of is that in the end, assuming that things go as planned, we're just going to have essentially three entities out there that are going to be able to put gas into that line when it comes down. Is that true, or am I coming to the wrong conclusion?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, again, the entities, the shippers of the gas, will be those folks that have gas on the North Slope available to sell to a pipeline.
And so I'm assuming that I am correct that ConocoPhillips, Exxon, and BP, since they've got the gas already, they are the only ones that can put gas into that line. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I'm not the expert in terms of the ownership of the Prudhoe Bay unit, so I'd have to defer to the Department of Natural Resources. I don't know that total gas ownership model.
And the concern I have, if that is indeed the case, and I'm not sure that is the case because I don't look, it's not my area of expertise, as much trouble as I, and since I'm the senator from the North Slope and living in Barrow, as much trouble and heartburn as I have of what goes on with the Shell and offshore exploration, if they find gas out there and only the other three are able to put gas into that line, Shell cannot put gas in that line. Is that correct? And maybe you're not the person to ask that question, so I'll ask it to somebody else. But that's what I'm – maybe Rena Delbridge can go ahead and answer the question since she's the sponsor. But is that the correct – is my thinking correct on it?
Senator Olson, through the chair, I understand why that might be the conclusion after what you heard yesterday, but no, anyone that has gas can participate. And yes, Exxon, BP, and ConocoPhillips have gas right now in the Prudhoe Bay unit. Right now, they're using that for greater recovery of the oil. Certainly, there is associated gas with most oil that you do find, I believe, on the North Slope. You have Repsol Exploring, you have Brooks Range Petroleum, you have Armstrong, you have Pioneer. You have a multitude of players that are up there and looking for things. If they have gas that they are ready to move off the slope, any of them can participate in that. The only boundary that exists as far as something like Shell and the OCS is concerned is whether or not this pipeline is able to expand in the future per AGIA. So providing that we're at a point in time, say 2025, when Shell is ready, providing that we are no longer bound by that AGIA license restriction, then that pipeline will expand. It must expand under this legislation on commercially reasonable terms.
So if Shell was, if I can continue, right, Mr. Chairman, so if Shell in their offshore exploration finds gas with a proportion that's commercially viable, there will be room in this pipeline for that gas that is out there from Shell.
Senator Olson, through the chair, there will be an expansion of the pipeline to support that additional gas if Shell wants it, providing that we aren't violating AGIA.
Will they have the same rates that the other three have at that rate?
Senator Olson, through the chair, the specific cost of that expansion, so potentially additional compression or whatnot, would be something that needs to be paid for by the person causing the expansion, just as the initial costs are paid for by the initial shippers on the pipeline. I would defer to Daryl Kleppen at AGDC to explain specifically what that rate would look like. He is, I believe, online if you would like.
No, that's all right.
Thank you.
That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, no, that's a good line of questioning. And I think as we heard early on this year, there's actually six producers up there. There's E&I, Pioneer, is it Savant, has that small field, Savant? And then I know Anadarko was looking for gas specifically in the foothills. We don't know if they found anything or not, but I would imagine all of those could be participants in this pipeline. Senator Dunleavy.
Through the chair, correct me if I'm wrong, but there was mention yesterday also of potential gas in Enana that could also be put into the pipeline. Was that correct?
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, Enana is beneath the 68th parallel, which means that it may not be subject to those capacity constraints under AGIA. So it's certainly possible to add additional capacity to a pipeline to bring gas from Enana south to a market.
Okay. Senator Frickhoff, did you have your hand up?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This goes to one of the issues. If I might, we have some guests in the gallery that may not understand all the acronyms, so if we could try to help with the acronyms a little bit more today. And so for those folks, the students that are here with us, we're talking about whether it's best for Alaska to move forward with a pipeline or should we wait and try to get a big pipeline? And so we had a conversation yesterday about a big pipeline, and now we're talking about the issues that are surrounding that big pipeline as we go forward. And so the issue that Senator Olson is raising was one of the issues that I asked you to respond to today, and that was the access issue. So we talked about access, and what I heard the committee asking for yesterday was if you could talk to us about access and the common carrier versus the contract carrier language that you have in the bill that's before us and how that will either deny access or allow access, how it's economical or uneconomical to bring that forward. So it's all around that access issue and an exclusive right or a monopoly that people are fear isn't the right word, but people have trepidation that the big three that currently have oil in Alaska's Trans-Alaska pipeline, if they could control the interests in a gas pipeline, and there is some trepidation about letting that happen.
Senator Fairclough, through the chair, I'm absolutely prepared to address all of that. However, there was a very serious allegation made yesterday regarding alleged legal opinion related to AGIA and whether to the Alaska Gasline Inducement Act provisions and to whether or not House Bill 4 violates that. And if we could, we'd like to take a quick moment to address that issue first. That's critical. The presentation yesterday pulled a few lines out of a legal, I think, 8-page opinion that is on basis and that has been submitted to this committee. The suggestion was that either the licensee was out of compliance and therefore the state should not be worried about an AGIA threshold anymore, or alternatively, that this legislation somehow violates AGIA because of design capacity. I think that reading the Ledge legal opinion, you will find that the ultimate finding is that the specific language in the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act requires the state to limit its support of other projects' design capacity. AGDC has been very, very careful to design a project, both through the size of the pipe, the additional facilities, the compression, and what they are prepared to offer as far as a half billion cubic feet of day in an open season, to make sure there is no violation of AGIA. The Department of Law has looked at this language repeatedly. AGDC's attorneys have looked at it repeatedly. Ledge Legal has looked at it repeatedly. Everyone is comfortable with this language. That said, I would also like to mention that the state does seem to believe that TransCanada is in fact in compliance with its license. There's been no allegation by the state that TransCanada is not in compliance with its license under AGIA, and I believe that providing these two contracting parties, TransCanada and the state, agree that TransCanada is in compliance, they are in compliance. If I could ask AGDC's attorney, Ken Vassar, online, if he would like to add anything to that.
I don't know. Is he online? I don't show him on my list. What's his name?
Hello,
again?
This is Ken Vassar.
Okay, Ken, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Could you repeat the question for me?
Ken, this is Rena. We're addressing the allegation made yesterday that that House Bill 4 somehow violates AGIA.
Thank you, Rena. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. This is Ken Vassar. I'm general counsel to AGDC. There's nothing in HB 4 that violates AGIA, and I don't think that a reasonable argument can be made that it does. AGDC has been very cautious about not violating AGIA throughout the course of its work in preparing the project that it's been working on. The question of whether AGIA remains in effect or not, which has been discussed from time to time recently, it really isn't our question to answer. We would, until somebody who's in an authoritative position to be able to say, to tell us clearly and definitely that AGIA is no longer in effect, we are going to comply with AGIA. And primarily what that means is that we're not going to do anything to design a pipeline project that will accommodate more than 500 million cubic feet per day of North Slope gas.
Anything else? Senator Fairclough, and then we'll go to Senator Dennehy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. During that conversation yesterday, Ms. Delbridge, there was some comments about how if someone else was in charge of the project, what they would do, that they would reach out to those parties that might be aggrieved by the particular bill going forward and seeing if they agreed with us. I didn't know if that was standard practice. Do we reach out and ask for people to sue us, or do we proceed along, and if someone didn't like the process, I don't know how that works in putting a major project together. Has the administration, who is still supportive of the AGIA process and still trying to work to move that big line forward, are they still in contact with TransCanada? Is it appropriate for AGDC, or just if you could provide any guidance? I know that was commented to that someone might want to contact TransCanada and ask if we're in violation.
Senator Fairclough, through the chair, let me address briefly that point. I believe that if TransCanada, I believe that it would be unnecessary to ask TransCanada if we are in compliance or not. I believe that the state commissioners and TransCanada that have that contract are the ones that essentially determine that. And then I believe if we could, Frank Richards has something to add regarding the other part of your question regarding communication on an AGDC level.
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, the governor was very clear to us in the State of the State in conversations that we are to work cooperatively with the applicant, TransCanada, and the Alaska Pipeline Project and or the South Central LNG Project. And we are, again, having dialogue and discussions with that project and with those companies. Again, it is somewhat at arm's length because of the issue of confidentiality, but we are working very cooperatively with them.
Senator, Mr. Chair, thank you. Just some clarity, which for me is actually very important. Regarding the AGEA agreement, is it the design of the pipe, the size of the pipe, or is it the volume that's actually going to go through the pipe that is constrained by AGEA? Because they could be two different things. And I'm hearing design from the man on the line, and I've heard yesterday, I think, from others that it's volume. What is it exactly, please?
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, if I may read, essentially the statute, the definition for a competing natural gas pipeline project means a project designed to accommodate throughput of more than 500 million cubic feet a day of North Slope gas to market. And so the design and the amount of gas going through go hand in hand.
Okay, follow up. Could the pipe, the size of the pipe, be such that it theoretically could exceed that amount, but the processor or the compression stations constrain that amount? How does that factor into the design? In other words, could you have a large pipe that theoretically could carry much larger capacity than what is constrained under AGEA, but the compression stations, the processing stations, however you want to word it, are designed that they cannot, and does that pass the AGEA bar, or does the pipe itself, which could exceed the capacity, dictate whether we are in compliance or violation?
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, it's quite clear in the AGEA statute that it means a project, a pipeline project, which means the actual pipe plus the facilities that are related to that pipe. Frank, did you want to elaborate on that?
I did. Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, as we discussed the other day, when we looked at the modifications to the project design from 2011 to 2012, and looked at increasing the pipe size, it was, again, a trade-off between pipe diameter, pressure, the compression, and the processing ability. So, again, the ceiling for us is that 500 million cubic foot a day flow through the pipe. So that is the processing of the gas and the compression of the gas to flow that amount of gas. To get to the lowest tariff for in-state Alaska use, we looked at various pipe diameter sizes to look at the cost then of that pipe with that throughput, and derived the 36 inch as the lowest cost for that project.
One last question. There seems to be at least from my perspective, I don't want to say a hang up, but I guess a question over pipe size for future capacity 20, 30, 40, 50 years down the road that may supersede the AGEA situation. Don't know where that's going to go. And route and or terminus seems to be the issues that, for lack of a better term, may be dividing certain camps within the state of Alaska. I mean, we all want gas. We all know we have gas. We all know we have an energy issue. But for me, it's understanding whether we can increase the size of the pipe under HB4, but not violate AGEA because our processors and compressors do not allow more than X amount of gas through, or whether we can't have larger pipe in the event that we may want to ship a higher percentage or a higher volume of gas.
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, I believe I understand what you're asking here. Providing that your processing facilities didn't, if, for example, you had a larger pipe diameter than was necessary, you would be in a difficult situation because, first of all, through the regulatory framework, you were required to have cost-based rates. If you have an additional amount of pipe that was unnecessary for the amount of gas that you are shipping, there could be some issues there because recovering the costs of that additional diameter pipe is not something that, would be able to be wrapped back into that cost-based rate the consumers are paying. So there are some challenges with that, with how you would financially manage that kind of a concept. And ultimately, I believe it would be up to the Department of Law and AGDC's attorneys to determine what ultimately in that design situation would and would not work under the terms of AGEA.
Thank you.
Okay. Was there additional questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Delbridge, as you look at page 37, the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, and you continue on down through the way, the RCA does play a prominent part during the initial part of the construction. But then later on it says that essentially they go away and the pipeline is essentially pipeline people or participants are essentially on their own.
Senator Olson, through the chair, the RCA does play a very prominent role in the early stages, in part because that's when the contracts are made that govern the pipeline's relationship with its customers for many years. Any time, though, the RCA can come back in full effect at any point at which somebody wants an expansion. Then you go through an open season again. Before that, you have to go through that same process of an initial recourse rate, a current one, for that expanded capacity. And so really the process kicks in again at any point in the future at which somebody seeks access to this pipeline. One of the points that has been raised, of course, is whether or not people have access. And this regulatory structure, coupled with the requirements in the state right-of-way lease covenants, require mandatory expansions on commercially reasonable terms, provided that those do not violate AGEA. So there is access to this pipeline. Open seasons have to be conducted fairly. They have to be, a capacity has to be awarded on a non-discriminatory basis. There were a lot of assumptions yesterday that that this process, this regulatory framework was less than reasonable, was a fundamental rewrite. I think someone maybe used the term disemboweling the RCA, and nothing could be farther from the truth. First of all, nothing in this regulatory framework changes the way that the RCA regulates public utilities, and nothing changes the way that the RCA regulates common carrier oil pipelines. Alaska has never had a major natural gas transportation pipeline, and therefore there is reason to have a regulatory framework that in fact addresses that situation. This was modeled very closely to FERC's process for regulating contract carrier gas pipelines in the lower 48. What you heard about yesterday were some special terms that FERC has for one pipeline, an overland pipeline from Alaska to the lower 48. In part, those were added as in light of this lower 48 line being a national interest project. And everyone's right. There is no way there will ever be two lower 48 natural gas pipelines built from Alaska. 2,000 miles long, just to, I think, the hub in Alberta. That warranted very particular terms. For example, that is the only instance in which FERC does require an open season. They do not require those for contract carrier natural gas pipelines in the lower 48. Of course, in the lower 48, there is a competitive market. So that is one of the reasons that the sponsors of this legislation made sure to require an open season for any Alaska natural gas pipeline project. That's one way that we can assure that in a non-competitive environment, there is access available to everyone. Better yet, it's access available at an RCA-approved initial recourse rate if you don't want a contract for it. That upfront approval of that initial recourse rate, coupled with the open season procedures, which include most of the same things that the FERC's open season procedures for a lower 48 Alaska gas line include. All of your open season procedures for conducting this have to be noticed up front in your initial recourse tariff before an open season even starts. You have to give reasonable notice of that open season. You have to list the initial approved recourse tariff in there so everyone knows what's available to them. You have to show what kind of the final agreements of precedent agreements and firm service agreements are going to look like so people know what they're able to negotiate and what they can't. You have to define the route, the capacity, the operating pressures, the in-service date, quality specifications for the gas. You have to say in the rules up front how you are going to award capacity to the people that come and try and put bids on this pipeline. Everybody knows up front how you are going to deal with those bids and who's going to get the gas that everyone's bidding for, the space, excuse me, on that pipeline. Those procedures have to be non-discriminatory. You have to give all the people that come to play at this table an equal opportunity to get service on this pipeline. You have to notify people whether or not pre-subscription agreements have been made. So does FERC. You have to provide additional relevant information that's requested by your shippers. There are strong rules in this legislation right here governing an open season. There was also an allegation made yesterday that we could have, I guess I would caution against too many parallels with TAPS and the experience that the state has had with TAPS. TAPS is an oil pipeline. It is a common carrier. I believe you have multiple tariffs on this one pipeline. It is jointly regulated by a state body and a federal body. The concept of rate-based tariffs was complicated by state settlements on those methodologies that definitely complicated the situation. This pipeline would be governed, this gas pipeline, by firm contracts through the road. There are no settlement methodologies. There are no rate cases that go on for years and years. There's the concern that, particularly if some of the big players on the North Slope own part of this pipeline, that they will jack the tariffs up in order to reduce the wellhead value of the gas for purposes of production tax calculations. I want to point out to you that on page 50, line 30 through page 51, line 1, this legislation expressly prohibits that from happening. The Department of Revenue has a provision in statute that allows it to reject a tariff that someone claims for transporting its gas and instead decide what was reasonable. So first of all, it's unlikely that you're ever going to have that situation because your tariffs have to be cost-based. RCA-approved, cost-based tariffs. Reasonable rate of return, reasonable capital structure, reasonable depreciation method. They won't have the evidence and the numbers to jack that up. You can negotiate from there, but if those contracts look funny, particularly if they are between affiliated parties, for example, a producer and a producer pipeline subsidiary, they get extra RCA scrutiny, and they go through the full just and reasonable that the RCA would use for a common carrier pipeline, because that's that extra protection for Alaska. There was also some issues about...
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Dalbridge, I'm not here to go ahead and refute what was said yesterday. That's not my question. My question, if I can continue on with it, has to do with the RCA. And with the RCA, the oversight is diminished, if not done away with. If there is a request by somebody else for access, and if somebody else asks for access, don't the big three have to go ahead and just give the nod before they go ahead and allow more gas to come through that line? Or did I misread what's going on here?
Senator Olson, through the chair, if you'll forgive me, the RCA doesn't go away. Contracts that were approved by the RCA govern the business of gas going through this pipeline. And if someone else wants to come and put gas in an in-state natural gas contract carrier pipeline, even if the big three own it, if the person that wants the expansion can show the RCA, who gets to decide, mm-hmm. that it's a commercially reasonable expansion, then they can order that expansion. The RCA may order that expansion.
The concern I have, Mr. Chairman, has to do with you have a producer up on the North Slope, which is where I represent, and they not just are producing up there and don't have access or have the controllability of the gas there, they also control the corridor with which it comes down to Tidewater, wherever that happens to be. That seems like there's almost a monopolistic attitude toward what the price of gas might be. Where am I wrong in my thinking? And they can go ahead and charge whatever price they want to.
Senator Olson, through the chair, charge whatever price they want to transport the gas?
No, on that and have the burner tip price be almost unregulated. Or what's to their best advantage to make a profit?
Senator Olson, through the chair, actually under this regulatory framework, I don't believe that's something that can happen. Again, to walk through the process, if somebody wants in on this line and they have a commercially reasonable prospect, mm-hmm. the owner has to let them on, or the RCA will order them to build the expansion and to make room for that shipper. As far as the costs go, whether it's initial capacity or whether it's an expansion down the road, they have to set an initial recourse tariff that is cost-based with all that evidence that shows specifically what your costs are. And your costs include your operating and maintenance, your depreciation, return, those kinds of things, the taxes due. The numbers are there before the RCA. It has to be cost-based. So they cannot jack it up without evidence. I mean, they have to show somewhere where that's increasing. And that the support, the factual foundation for that will not exist. They get the RCA sets the rate of return within reasonable. They approve the rate of return within a reasonable range. They approve the capital structure and the depreciation method. And then you can negotiate the rate. But again, we've talked about that and how if it's between affiliates, it goes under greater scrutiny. Now that shipper, if they don't want to negotiate with the big three, for example, they don't have to. They can take that initial recourse tariff rate. They always have that option.
Mr. Chairman, on that point.
On that point, go ahead, Senator.
On that point, you say RCA can order the expansion. Does that mean RCA can order the expansion with no regard to the limitations of AGEA?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, no. An RCA order of an expansion cannot violate AGEA. I was responding to a question that I thought was more about the big three owning a pipeline, in which case, if they had one under this chapter, AGEA probably wouldn't be a factor within that.
Okay, continue, Senator Olson.
And as you look at what's going on here, after the end of the construction of the pipeline, 5 and 10 years down the road, there are a number of assets. Those assets are going to be transferred. Is that correct?
Senator Olson, through the chair, could you clarify what kind of assets?
Okay, let me rephrase my question. There's public money going into a project that's going to include acquiring assets. The assets could be a corporation that's there like AGDC. It can be permits that that they have gone after and received, which are always very important because it's not an easy process to go in and get through that. And there are the physical assets that are out there, the facilities, the pipeline, et cetera, et cetera. Who owns those after 5 and 10 years after completion of the construction?
Senator Olson, through the chair, House Bill 4 is structured so that if it is an asset owned by AGDC, they are able to manage those, including sale or transfer. It's going to be up to AGDC to manage those assets in a way that helps them meet their mission, which again is getting gas to Alaskans at the lowest possible rate. If that means a joint ownership agreement, that's certainly a possibility. The permitting, of course, once you have your permits is there. It's not as much of an asset once you have everything in place and you're moving because it's been used in a public way. Your right-of-way lease, of course, carries with the pipeline itself. If there's a change in ownership, that has to be approved by the DNR commissioner for transfer to someone else. AGDC can retain some of these assets and be a participant or part owner in this pipeline on behalf of the state. Some of the assets, including the upfront work, including the upfront funding that the state puts in, can be used as an in-kind contribution in exchange for a state ownership potential percentage of this line. I think that the way AGDC has best explained this one to me is that it comes down to the art of the deal and maximizing those joint deals to benefit Alaskans
So you said on behalf of the state just a few sentences back about a minute ago. I thought the state would be out of it by then because it's obviously in private hands by then.
Senator Olson, through the chair, I'm sorry, I was talking about AGDC actually going through that process of transferring ownership.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Senator Faircloth, did you have a question a while ago that maybe it's been answered?
It's not your lucky day, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, there were other issues that we brought up that are starting to be talked about. One that comes to mind with the conversation we're having right now is the recourse rate. There was at least a statement that the recourse rate doesn't protect the state from inflating the pipeline owner's rate, and I think Ms. Delbridge covered it already in her comments. She also covered the comment that was made yesterday about the fundamental rewrite of an all-state pipeline. So maybe we could get into the rolled-in rates and the FERC exemption, because that was something else that at least we were trying to follow up on.
Senator Faircloth, through the chair, thank you. The rolled-in versus incremental rates issue. With rolled-in rates, all of your shippers bear the cost of expansions that gets distributed among all of them. With incremental rates, the person using the space pays for the creation of the space, the capital related to getting that space. With your new capacity, you have pipeline users who are paying their share of that pipeline's costs. That's your incremental kind of concept. And then in an expansion, whoever is creating the need for that expansion would bear those costs. And so the people that are using the space pay for the space. With rolled-in rates, you essentially go back and make people that didn't need that space pay for the space that someone in the future needs. The rolled-in rates were very important to some people under AGIA. And again, you were talking about a massive scale pipeline in which expansions as well were going to be expensive, and it was an important thing to a number of people under AGIA. You, I think, also have repeatedly heard the industry in the state that would be expected to shoulder the financial commitment, the financial burden of that cost of that pipeline to start with, as saying that they would not be able to sign on to a project requiring rolled-in rates. There's a reason for that. When you sign a contract for a specific amount of space in a pipeline over a period of 20 or 30 years at a given rate, you expect to be able to pay that contractual rate. There's no way that you can know at that day one how many people are going to want to expand, how much it's going to cost, how much more your rates are going to go up. And yet you're being asked to sign a contract for multiple decades. The nature of contractual commitments on a natural gas pipeline really prohibit that rolled-in rate concept in this instance. To be clear, FERC's, yesterday you heard that FERC required rolled-in rates on a lower 48 pipeline. And it was actually FERC saying that they would make a rebuttable presumption that rolled-in rates were the way to go. Now, a rebuttable presumption can be challenged with the evidence in the future when that scenario plays out. So it's not an absolute that those would in fact have been required. The concept that the sponsors very much believe is that the user pays. Those that are shouldering the initial costs of this pipeline should pay for that. And those that are shouldering, or those that are creating the cost of expansion should pay for that. Were there any questions before I moved on to FERC jurisdiction?
Senator Bishop.
Ms. Delbridge, staying with rolled-in rates for a minute in your explanation, and then now let's go to how a new entrant would get their gas in under the recourse rate plus the cost of expansion. Is that correct? That's how it would work under HB4.
Senator Bishop, through the chair, could we, for the sake of conversation, assume that AGIA is not an issue in compliance in this conversation? Thank you. Actually, under House Bill 4, you need to go set an initial recourse rate before you go into the open season for that expansion, a current one that reflects the cost of the expansion. And therefore, again, the user of the space pays for the space.
Okay.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Senator Bishop. Additional, Senator Faircloth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On that point, then, is the recourse rate different if there's capacity existing in the pipeline meeting AGIA? So if we only have the 250 million cubic feet moving and our pipeline were to proceed, would the recourse rate have an expansion rate in it, or would there be two rates, one for, you know, the first come, first serve, that we still have space left in a line? Again, moving to, if you were looking at a larger diameter pipe, you didn't have it full, how would you set that recourse rate?
Senator Faircloth, through the chair, to be clear, if there was only 250 million cubic feet subscribed in an open season, AGDC would likely need to go re-engineer the project. Again, we have the same scenario of that pre-build concept that we spoke about earlier. I know that if you decrease the volume, your rates would double. However, if you re-engineer it, it may not be double the cost. So that would be important. if there is available capacity, if there's 10% of this line that is not subscribed, but the subscriptions are enough to proceed with this project and do financing and all of that, that space is available. And the carrier under this legislation has to tell people that that space is available. And if somebody wants in on that space, then they need to make sure that that recourse tariff is updated with current information so that it's truly representative of the actual costs. We're assuming maybe 10 years after operations, okay? So actual costs, update your recourse tariff, hold your open season, because there might be other people that want to get in on that at the same time, and you need to be fair to all potential shippers. And then you go through the same process.
Go ahead, Senator Kirkhoff.
Mr. Chairman, it just goes to the point that was raised, why not build it bigger? And if we did, as far as economics goes, from your explanation, the tariff to Alaskans would be so much more, and that our expansion rate would be so much higher for a new entrant to come in because they have to cover the cost of the pipe. Do I have it right?
Senator Fairclough, through the chair, I think on the right track there. That initial recourse tariff, there's certain things that are generally I hope I use the right term. You have your capital costs of something like an expansion, but you also have the ongoing operations and maintenance of the whole pipeline. And that, of course, is spread amongst your pipeline users. And so there's different components. It's not as if the rate for an expansion would be only a function of the capital cost of the expansion.
Paul? Sure.
I know we're getting into the weeds now, Mr. Chairman, but Ms. Delbridge, how do you you would use the diameter that you currently have, and how would you determine, would it be the person coming to you, the new explorer on the North Slope that found natural gas and wanted to come on the system, would we just expand to that capacity, or would we go out and tell people that we were getting ready to do expansion and ask if we want a group of people to come in to lower those fixed costs?
Senator Fairclough, through the chair, any expansion results essentially, any request for an expansion results in an open season notification again. And so every time that you increase capacity on this pipeline, everybody that might be out there has an opportunity. If there's an expansion noticed and there's a producer that knows that they might be having that they found gas somewhere that's new, and in 3 years they think they can bring that online, clearly not the North Slope, but then they can participate at that point. They can arrange for that, or they can talk with the carrier and plan so that there is opportunity ongoing for everyone that needs access to get access.
Go ahead, Senator Cliff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll leave it at this question. With AGEA in place and the diameter of the pipe, how will we set a recourse rate if we're at capacity? Because there won't really be the possibility to expand. So does that create the access issue that we're talking about?
Senator Fairclough, through the chair, if you're maxed out and you're needing to be in a AGEA compliant pipeline as far as the volume that you're designed to carry, you don't need your recourse tariff anymore. What you have are your contracts that are governing those shippers. If there was a small little bit of that pipeline that the carrier had that was not per contract, they need to offer that maybe a short-term interruptible service, then you would need your recourse tariff, and then you would probably need to have it updated because your shipper that would be using it wants to make sure that it's based on current information, actual costs.
Thank you. Okay. Very good. Did I see another hand up? Senator Bishop?
If he's thinking about
just
it,
to follow up with what, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
With what, I mean, like Anna said, you know, we could sit here and talk about this till the cows come home as far as options and scenarios and et cetera, but just to follow up where Senator Fairclough was going, we could go to open season and only 250M subscribed, that's firm, FTs. And you're absolutely right that AGDC would have to go back and then redesign their pipeline, because the goal of this bill is to bring gas to Alaskans at the most affordable rate, and as it is in these plans right now, this is a fully subscribed pipeline to bring these rates in Fairbanks and Anchorage, right?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, you're correct. AGDC would need to essentially go back, re-engineer, and see if, in fact, their new estimates for a 250 million cubic foot line had tariffs that were, in fact, competitive for Alaskans. They know their mission and their charge has been the gas that they deliver. Nobody wants gas at any rate. If it's not competitive with what's currently being paid, nobody is going to sign up to ship gas on that pipeline.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Senator Olson, did you have?
Actually, he's talked about gas at the least price for Alaska. I don't see that anywhere in the title. My question has more to do with if the pipeline is contracted at 500 million cubic feet per day, and isn't it true that since that's the maximum capacity that is essentially permitted for, that no other company can put gas into that line? Is that right?
Senator,
at least that's what I'm reading. Yeah. Is that?
It depends on whether or not the size is constrained by AGEA.
Okay. So it is true that if we get half a billion cubic feet, nobody else is going to have access to that line.
Senator Olson, through the chair, providing that AGEA is still in place, you cannot go over that. That is not AGDC is fully equipped in the regulatory environment, and the right-of-way lease fully empowers expansions once AGEA is not in the way.
So you can't have an open season because you can't put any more gas in the lane.
Senator Olson, through the chair, that's correct.
So if Shell comes on with more gas, or it's coming off the Chukchi or off the Beaufort Sea, they can't get into that lane anyway.
Senator Olson, through the chair, it would depend at that future point in time, likely a decade or more from now, whether or not AGEA is still in effect.
Well, I think, with all due respect, I think Shell is going to be having gas here in the very near future, and maybe on production line a lot sooner than AGEA expires.
Senator Olson, through the chair, I'm sure some people would love to see that happen exactly as you've described.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Additional questions? Okay, Senator Faircliff.
Mr. Chairman, we haven't heard, we heard a little bit about FERC, but I didn't know if we wanted any further comments on FERC. And then the other large issue that supports a larger diameter pipe, even though that would be in violation of AGEA, so I'll just put that on the table. But we talked about export volumes yesterday. So can you talk about in the current proposal before us in HB4, if there's excess capacity, if the state's using 250 million cubic feet a day and we were able to export, is there anything in here that stops that exporting, and why wouldn't we go to a bigger line and build it bigger so that we could enter into contracts around the world for exporting? Just exporting and economics was...
Senator Fairclough, through the chair, your couple of points and questions in there actually relate together here. One thing we have not addressed yet is the matter of FERC jurisdiction, FERC regulatory jurisdiction. First of all, to be very clear, on page 36 of this bill, lines 24 to 28, we make it quite clear that if there is an in-state natural gas pipeline that's subject exclusively to federal jurisdiction, this chapter does not apply. The state can't tell FERC to regulate something, and the state cannot force FERC out if FERC has jurisdiction. The bottom line is that FERC has jurisdiction in some cases and not in some others, and FERC will be the decider of whether or not FERC has jurisdiction in the instances in which there might be some discretion involved. Generally speaking, if there is a in-state natural gas pipeline with no export, there is no FERC jurisdiction. If there is an in-state natural gas pipeline that is does have an export component, FERC may have jurisdiction under certain scenarios. Partly it could depend on where that gas goes. If it's being shipped to Hawaii or the West Coast, FERC might have a little bit more of a window of jurisdiction. Of course, that's not likely to happen given this demand on the West Coast or need. if there's exports to Asia, FERC might look at how much of the capacity of this pipeline is going to export versus in-state use. And if there is a significant capacity going to export, FERC might have standing to claim jurisdiction over the pipeline. However, FERC is not going to be sharing jurisdiction with anyone over the pipeline. If they decide to regulate it, they will regulate it, all of it, including the in-state volumes.
If you could identify yourself for the record, Mr. Richards, and then proceed.
Madam Chairman, Frank Richards, Alaska Gasline Development Corporation. I believe what Mr. Delbridge, or I know what Mr. Delbridge just said was correct. I think that the FERC jurisdiction, again, is going to come in with the LNG facility. That's where FERC has on its books the requirements to come in and part of that process. The current AGDC pipeline, the concept is to deliver gas from the North Slope into the Beluga pipeline at mile 29 of the NSTAR system. So there is not an LNG export component associated specifically with the AGDC project.
Thank you. Senator Bishop.
Okay, so now we're on that pathway. Under this bill, how do we assure ourselves that, let's say there is 250 MMcf export LNG, how do we is there enough language in here in negotiations to make sure that once that gas leaves the tidewater, then it's not stranded anymore? And so how do we make sure, can we negotiate our in-state rate and it won't be elevated with the LNG export rate?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, there's nothing about AGDC that would address the commodity price of the gas. AGDC as a pipeline shipper is strictly about shipment of the gas. And so people selling gas to in-state customers will negotiate a price for sale of that gas, and people selling gas to a foreign market would negotiate the price of that gas.
Follow up, Senator Bishop. Thank you. Are there other questions? Senator Olson.
Mr. Delbridge, as you look at the issue of the state and its owning and the possibility of owning the gas line and those kind of issues up there, as well as regulating the gas line, are there any legal questions that caused for a conflict of interest from that standpoint?
Senator Olson, through the chair, there are no legal questions that have been brought to our attention. The Regulatory Commission of Alaska is, of course, part of state government. It is also a quasi-judicial body. AGDC is a standalone independent corporation of the state. There have been no issues brought to our attention along those lines.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Are there other questions from committee members? Ms. Delbridge, if you could provide us some closing comments from the sponsor's perspective. Mr. Richards, anything that is remaining?
Senator Fairclough, through the chair, if the committee's pleasure, there were a couple suggestions related to AGDC's bonding provisions within this bonding and financial provisions within this legislation that Department of Revenue has made a few recommendations on. We would certainly appreciate an opportunity for Joe Dubler, AGDC Vice President, online to explain why we would be asking the committee to consider these additions to the legislation.
Yes, I think Mr. Dubler is online. Is that correct? Do you have a Mr. Dubler? Okay. Mr. Dubler, are you online, sir?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. I'm not sure I heard the question, but you were going to comment on the bonding aspect and the financing.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, if it's okay with you, I would, for the record, Joe Dubler, Vice President and Chief Financial Officer of the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation.
Okay, go ahead.
And there were three changes that we proposed, and I'm assuming that's what Ms. Delbridge was referring to?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, the first one is in section... It's 3125070, which is in section, which of the bill? Section 3 of the bill on page 10 of my version. We added a number 22, which allows AGDC to enter into
Okay, can,
hedges.
Joe, can you hold on here a second? So what page are you on again?
I'm on page 10.
Page 10, all right. Okay, give us a second here to get caught up with you.
Sure.
Excuse me, if I may, I believe we're on page 9.
Okay.
Oh, page 9, I'm sorry.
Okay, page 9.
The, okay. Number 22, the addition would allow AGDC to enter into hedges, which would allow the corporation to hedge, for instance, the price of steel. This project, approximately half of the project cost is going to be in purchasing steel, both for pipe and for facilities. And this would allow us to ensure that we did not experience significant inflation by hedging at least a part of that steel purchase. And it's something that we have vetted through the Department of Revenue and the Department of Law, and they're both okay with the language that we've proposed here.
Okay, Senator Faircloth.
Thank you. Mr. Dubler, when you say entering into hedges, when would you propose that you would be looking at steel to purchase? At what gate in this process would we anticipate a capital expenditure, and is that inside of the existing appropriation that you've requested or that AGDC has requested?
Senator Faircloth, through the chair, that's an excellent question because, no, it's not included in the appropriation that we have before you. It would be out of bond proceeds and or equity contributions from owners or co-owners of the project.
If I may, Rena Delbridge, on the record, I think what you just heard from Mr. Dubler is that would be part of the project cost and not an additional appropriation from the state.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, if I may,
that's
also
correct.
Frank Richards, AGDC, the time to order the steel is going to be after the decision to proceed with project sanction.
Senator Faircloth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Richards, and that's where I was going to. That means that you had an open season and that you've secured contracts that would be a bondable asset to go out to a capital market to acquire capital?
Through the chair, Senator Faircloth, that's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, very good. Mr. Richards?
Mr. Chairman, if I might, you raised a good point in regards to the level of effort to get to that project sanction. And I believe that the committee has the fiscal note that came over from the House Finance side, and that fiscal note was at an amount of approximately $250 million, not the $330 million that we've identified as the necessary funds to proceed through to that project sanction. And if I may, with your indulgence, Mr. Chairman, identify why that's necessary for that full funding as opposed to the partial funding.
Okay, could you give us the fiscal note you're referring to, number 3, I'm assuming?
Mr. Chairman, we'll get one off the back table.
You know, but before you go to the fiscal notes, let me just ask you a question. You know, we keep hearing that we're limited by AGEA on the pipe size and how much gas we can put down the pipe. I'm assuming to get out of the AGEA contract is the triple damages, which is cost prohibitive. That's why we're not looking at that option. Is that safe to say?
Mr. Chairman, likely the Department of Law or our attorney, Ken Vassar, are the best ones to answer that. We, because AGEA is in place, then that is the law of the land that we are governed by.
Okay. Well, I think there is a way out of that agreement, but it was pretty expensive, if I recall. So,
Mr. Chairman, I believe it's not just, there's a couple ways out of it. I wouldn't just say we're limited to one.
Okay. I just want to know if that option was looked at. Senator Faircloth.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that this project is going forward, keeping AGEA on the table, and that there would be a goal, actually, if we could get enough gas going together, that we would have a larger pipeline based on the contract carriage that's proposed in this. And this is a framework to allow, dependent on a market and a willing buyer and a willing seller, that we would be able to move as much gas that we could actually attract. But My point is that we're not trying to circumvent the AGEA project or try to move them out of the way. We believe both is on the table for advantage to Alaskans.
Gotcha. Yep.
Senator Faircloth, through the chair, the sponsors wholeheartedly agree with you, and I you know, the governor has repeatedly called on AGDC and this other project to communicate, to discuss ways that they might in fact align and work together to bring a project to Alaska that generates the most possible benefits for Alaskans. Those options are absolutely on the table.
Okay. Yep. That makes sense. Thank you very much. Okay. Are we ready to go over the fiscal notes?
Mr. Chairman, there are two more points on the bonding.
Oh, sure.
Mr. Dubler.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Got to one of them, so I was looking to hear what the other two points for our consideration were.
Mr. Dubler, back to you, sir. Maybe not.
Mr. Chairman, if you'd like, I can.
I just got unmuted, Mr. Chairman. Sorry about that.
No problem.
For the record, again, it's Joe Dubler from AGDC. The second one was on page 9, number 18. And what we would like to do is strike all the language after on line 15, after obligations, through available on page 16. So we would be striking for a period not exceeding 1 year after the date on which the corporation estimates funds will otherwise be available. And what this removal does is it allows us to borrow construction funds for more than 1 year. Typically a project, you would borrow construction funds, you want to keep them as short as possible. And for most smaller projects, 1 year can be enough. This project has a construction period in excess of a year, and we would need to potentially borrow on a construction lending basis for a time period that extended past 1 year. So we'd like to remove that language.
Was there other points, Mr. Dubler?
Yes, I'm sorry, I was see if there are any questions on that. The third point was on section 3125, 30, which is on page...
Page 23, line 7.
Yeah, page 23, line 7. From pending through the remainder of that paragraph, we would like to remove. And what that language does in the bill that you have before you is it restricts the type of investments that we're allowed to utilize in a refunding transaction to the extent we were to sell bonds and at some point in the future go out and refund those bonds. This restricts the investments that we could make with the proceeds of those refunding bonds to U.S. Treasury obligations or securities secured or guaranteed by the U.S. federal government. And the point that our counsel made was that there may be a negotiation between the bondholders of the refunding transaction and us that would allow us to purchase securities that would have a higher yield than U.S. Treasury obligations, which currently have very low yields, that would benefit the transaction. And it would be beneficial if we had that option available to us.
Okay. All right. Anything else, Mr. Dubler?
No, Mr. Chairman, that concludes the issues that I wanted to cover with the committee. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Thank you for joining us today. Mr. Richards, we're going to break at probably about 9:45 to set up for a conference committee. But does that allow enough time to discuss the fiscal notes?
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Please proceed, then.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to refer to the fiscal note number 3, dated April 1, 2013. In that, Mr. Chairman, it identifies an appropriate FY14 appropriation requested of $225 million with an estimated capital.
Okay. Let's take a brief at ease so everybody can find their fiscal notes.
I've just got two.
Okay, brief at ease. Ready, cameraman? We're ready. Okay. Let's see. We left with the discussion of the fiscal notes. Mr. Richards.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Frank Richards, Alaska Gasline Development Corporation. And again, we were talking about fiscal note number 3. In it, an appropriation for $225 million with an estimated capital project of $25 million. What this does is capitalizes the In-State Natural Gas Fund with the $225 million Alaska Housing Capital Corp receipts and includes the $25 million that's already in the capital, the governor's capital request for $25 million for, again, Alaska Housing Capital Corporation receipts. My point today was wanted to talk to the committee about the need for the full funding. We've identified in our project plan in 2011 and again in 2012 the amount of funds that will be necessary to drive this project through an open season and ultimately to project sanction. That $330 million will be used to advance the pipeline engineering, the facilities engineering, our environmental work, our right-of-way, our health safety work, all work which needs to be done to advance the project design to a point where we can develop that Class 3 estimate. Again, that's an estimate that will be industry standard at the time of the open season. The point of the need for the full funding beyond the open season or through the open season is to get to that level of detail. We have hired and will be hiring a tremendous amount of resources in the terms of consultants, design engineers, process engineers, environmental and regulatory people. And that team assembled will be the ones that are driving through over the next year and a half to get us to an open season. The tremendous work, the talent that we'll be demanding from those consultants will be key to us achieving that goal. We will be asking for and demanding the best and the brightest to come forward and design this work over this time frame. To keep that project team available as we go through the open season deliberations is what is key. Because the challenge is if you develop a team and you have a team and you've worked through the process and then you have a hiatus or a timeout for a number of months, then those project team members, those consultants, are going to be off onto other jobs. There's a tremendous amount of work in the lower 48, and which will mean that they will have opportunities and work opportunities to work on other projects. So it's very important for us as a project to be able to work through that process of a post-open season when we will be getting ideas or requirements coming to us from the shippers and the buyers of the gas on what modifications they want to that project. So before we get to a project sanction, there may be component redesigns, process redesigns that we will have to then go through to meet the requirements of those shippers. Those are the people that are going to be committing to sell their gas, to flow their gas down that pipeline for 30 years. It's that commitment that we will then go to the bond market. It is key then that we are able to retain the level of staff, the consultant staff, to be able to push this project through so that we have and retain and do not lose the momentum during that post-open season hiatus when we were going to be looking at the tariffs and the conditions coming to us. So it's my point that AGDC, with the goal and design to bring the project into the lowest possible cost, we see that by having full funding, we would then be able to continue the work through that open season to keep that staff available so that we wouldn't have to necessarily come back to the legislature at that point, because with the $225 million identified on the fiscal note, that gets us through the open season. And we would then have to come back to the legislature for the remaining amount to be able to complete the project and go out to project sanction. So there would be an added time delay and an added burden and expense potentially to the state from the delay of the project. The work that would be going on during that time immediately after the open season will again continue on with the regulatory work that we have in place that is going to be mandated of us. The Pipeline Hazardous Materials and Safety Administration, that part of the USDOT that governs pipeline safety, is going to require us to have a full-blown testing program for not only pipe samples, but full-blown pipe segments, as Senator Bishop and I have seen firsthand in Calgary with a full-blown segment that actually is pushed through to failure, both in compression and tension. We also have to continue on with the what's known as SCADA, Supervisory Control and Data Acquisition System, that will be integral to the pipeline management once it's built for the future, to manage and make sure that there is oversight and control of that pipeline and all the mainline block valves and associated infrastructure.
Actually, Mr. Richards, we have a question here from Senator Bishop.
Could you pipe testing? So this pipeline, will it be strain-based tested?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, the Pipeline Hazard Safety Administration, through the USDOT, has made a determination that essentially any natural gas pipeline in Alaska will be strain-based design.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Richards.
For the uninitiated, that means because we have discontinuous permafrost and we were going to have a cold pipe, therefore the issue is, how is it going? That pipe going to handle the frost heave that it will experience over its life? So in addition to that safety administration, we also will have to work with the Department of Homeland Security and the Transportation Security Administration on the security aspects of this project. Because it's going to be such a key and integral point to the heating as well as power generation for the state of Alaska and our citizens, we feel that the Department of Homeland Security will see it as a critical piece of infrastructure, and they're going to want to make sure that we have critical security measures in place. The list goes on and on, corrosion protection and engineering. We just need to make sure that we have and are not experiencing a time delay from the time of open season through to that project sanction, which could be delayed by months coming back through to the legislature. So, Mr. Chairman, it's my hope that we'll be able to have the full funding to be able to proceed through that project sanction.
Okay. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to reconcile this fiscal note with the report that we received in January 11 on page 5, 1.3, status of AGDC's recommendation, the second one. It says in July, the recommendation was the state of Alaska should appropriate $210 million with a footnote down here, assuming the approval of $29 million to be appropriated in the 27th Alaska Legislature. And then we would recognize that $130 million more will be required. And that was 3 months ago. So how does the update 3 months ago compared to this fiscal note and what you're testifying today to?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, on page 5 of the year-end 2012 ASAP project plan update, that first column is the recommendations from the July 2011 project plan.
So it was included in this report.
That's right.
It was January, 3 months ago.
So it was included. So the purpose of this section was to identify what were the prior recommendations coming out of the original project plan in July 2011, and then what has happened or not happened subsequent to that. So over that,
and what has not happened is in December you said these funds have not been appropriated. As a result, AGDC has not been able to pursue.
Through the chair, Senator Hall.
What I'm saying is that it does not rectify the numbers in December, so I'm assuming the July numbers were the same in 3 months ago at the end of December of 12, but how do they relate to what you've testified to fiscal note number 3 and what is needed and the difference, I guess, between the 25 and the 29 million in footnote number 4?
Through the chair, Senator Happen, what's happened is that the time has happened from July of 2011 to now April of 2013, and what we have done to advance the project in the time frame, again, which was derived through to a project sanction at the earliest possible date.
What has happened, I guess my question is, what has happened between December and now, 3 months ago? Because if something happened between July and December, that footnote wasn't changed in December. What has happened differently from December 31 and today.
Mr. Chairman, I see the issue that you're raising here. I think that it's one of, we were trying to identify in that section, again, what was originally proposed, where we are now, that no funds had been appropriated to this date to push through with the detailed engineering. And then later in the report, I believe we identified what we want in regards to the total project moving forward through project sanction.
So let me get this straight to you. In July, you were asking for $29 million to be appropriated for this legislature. That was reduced by $4 million to the $25, and then you're asking that additional dollars be appropriated or be considered so that you don't have to come back before the legislature, and that number is the 130, or is that a different number?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, on page 7 of the report, it identifies the stage gate process that we have worked forward and presented to the legislature. Again, on the left-hand portion, it identifies it as FEL 1, front-end loaded phase 1 at $30 million, with a FEL 2, front-end loaded phase 2 at $240, and finally FEL 3 at $130 million. As I described previously in testimony, AGDC and our predecessors at the Department of Natural Resources and the Governor's Office have received approximately $72 million worth of appropriation through the end of 2013. In order to push forward through FEL 2 through and to FEL 3, it's that additional $330 million.
Anything else there, Senator Hoffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Did you have additional comments, Mr. Richards?
No, Mr. Chairman. It's just one really of efficiency and ultimately one of the lowest possible cost to Alaskans.
Senator Bishop.
Mr. Chairman, going back to Mr. Richards, let's go back to 1.2, page 5, just for clarification. The federal right-of-way lacking was that 90 miles?
Through the chair, the federal right-of-way with the Bureau of Land Management is approximately 100 miles.
So 100 miles, and so we're still waiting that. Do you have an inkling when you might see that, or?
Through the chairman, Senator Bishop, an inquiry to the BLM as early as Monday of this week, we were waiting for our record of decision, and it's pending any day now. So we're waiting for the director's signature on that record of decision, which will be the BLM action.
Thank you.
Okay. Yes, Rena, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The sponsors are very supportive, of course, of full funding for AGDC, in part for a little bit of another reason. When AGDC goes before the private sector and potential shippers and puts an offer on the table that they're expecting the private sector to respond to, and in fact to sign conditioned agreements committing to for several decades, they believe it's very important for the state to be in a position in which the state appears able to follow through on what the state is asking them to the private sector to commit to in the first place. They believe that full funding to carry the project on through to sanctioning is that demonstration by the state that the state is in fact committed to supporting AGDC, providing that they have these sufficient shipper commitments in that open season to move forward. I know I would be remiss if I did not add that. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Delbridge. Okay, this looks like a good time to break. I don't know what else the committee members would like to hear, but I don't think our break will take too long, a half hour, Senator Kelly? Okay. If everyone who's here could come back at 4:30, that would be very helpful, and then we can continue our questioning and then we'll finish up. I don't think we have too much more to cover, so shouldn't be too much longer after 4:30. So with that, we'll stand at recess then until 4:30. All right, we're bringing the Senate Finance back to order. Before we recess, we were talking about the fiscal notes pertaining to House Bill 4, so I'd like to continue that discussion and then finish up with any questions the committee members may have. We'll have the two sponsors come to the table. We can ask them questions, and we'll give them an opportunity for final comments. But let's go to the fiscal notes first, and Mr. Richards, if you would join us, please. I believe you're the chosen one to go over the fiscal notes. Is that correct?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Frank Richards, Alaska Gasline Development Corporation. I wouldn't know if I would designate myself as the chosen one. Maybe the elected one.
Okay, very good.
Mr. Chairman, you have two notes accompanying House Bill 4. The first note is fiscal note number 2, dated April 1, 2013. I'm getting some feedback. I'm sorry.
Feedback? Is there feedback? You heard the feedback?
It's low. It's hurt by the low one.
All right. Do we need to keep talking so you can find it, or should we take it at ease?
I think it's related to any cell phones. You think it's the speaker?
You know, I don't think we were doing
it.
No, Kim Hutchison.
Still owes us those, yeah.
Let's take a brief at ease. All right, we're back. Okay, so, Mr. Richards, sorry about that. Maybe it's a, I think it's a cell phone, so I'm hoping that cell phone goes off, because we're hungry. By the way, Mr. Hutchinson hasn't paid from a couple days ago, so if you see him out and about, he's now up to double. So, okay, Mr. Richards, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, we have two fiscal notes in front of us today. First fiscal note, number 2. Identifying the costs for not only the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation, but that of agencies, including the Department of Law, the Department of Natural Resources, the Department of Environmental Conservation, and the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, and subsequent subdivisions within those individual departments. And this represents the cost of the total project for AGDC to run again through to through an open season, and for the projects it is to start in fiscal year 14 and running out through fiscal year 2019. Essentially the agencies will be staffing up and doing their regulatory process for the project for AGDC as well as they would for any other major pipeline project. So it's an indication of from each of the individual agencies. There's a fiscal note attachment to fiscal note number 2 that goes into quite significant detail for each of the agencies, including the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation, on how the monies will be spent on each individual fiscal year, the identification of the necessary PCNs that they will need to accomplish those regulatory actions, and how they are working that through the project development and then ultimately through project construction, and then sunsetting at the end of the project construction when the project is complete. So, Mr. Chairman, if you would like, I could run through each of the individual agencies, or we could talk in the broad terms. There is an accompanying spreadsheet at the back of fiscal note number 2 that identifies by agency, by individual sub-recipient within those agencies by fiscal year from 2014 through 2019.
Okay, what's the wish of the committee? I think we're pretty good. You can stay at the broad level.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And again, on fiscal note number 3, that was the $225 million that was going to be used to capitalize the in-state natural gas pipeline fund, which would allow for AGDC to advance the project through to an open season. So the net of those two fiscal notes is approximately $250 million for the project to advance.
Okay, and let's see. The fund source for the 225 was Alaska Housing, is that correct?
The fund source, Mr. Chairman, is from the Alaska Housing Capital Corp receipts.
Yep. Okay. Yep, I see it. Okay. With $25 million already in the capital budget.
Yes, correct. That was in the governor's request for $25 million, again, with Alaska Housing Capital Corporation receipts.
Okay. Very good. Any other questions on the fiscal notes? We're good. Thank you, Mr. Richards.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, so at this time, if I could have Representative Chenault, Representative Hawker come to the table, entertain any additional questions and also allow you any time for any additional comments that you may want to make. As the sponsors of this bill.
You want a back cleanup?
No. Yeah.
All right. Okay. Mr. Chairman, thank you again. It's very much a privilege to be before the committee. I'm Representative Mike Hawker, District 27 in Anchorage. And it strikes me I really wanted to talk briefly here, kind of as we bring this hearing to a close. There's another one. I wanted to talk about the three C's that are on my mind. As the letter C. First is courtesy, and I sincerely appreciate the great courtesy that you have granted us and our staff as we've presented this legislation. It's very much appreciated as we've definitely wanted to work, and I believe we hopefully have successfully worked with you and your committee to respond to every question and concern that you might have. As we're down talking, this is Finance Committee, places near and dear to both Speaker Chenault and my heart, having spent an awful lot of our career here with the chairman. Continuity.
And the vice chairman, too, I believe.
And with the vice chairman. And yes. Continuity. The request for the full amount of Capital Corp money really allows AGDC the ability of continuity of process, which we heard Mr. Richards present, and that's so very important. I'm sure Mr. Chenault will say it in a much simpler manner than I do, but it's so important that we don't force a disruption in the process that further increases risk, increases delay, increases project costs, increases uncertainty. And that's what why we are respectfully asking for the full funding so that they have continuity of process. And why that is so important is also that it brings us it will give them the resources they need to bring their, that is AGDC, to bring their assigned task to completion. And that is to take, if that is the appropriate course, and if and only if there is an underlying financial transaction that develops, to take a project all the way to sanction. the state's money that we are requesting is well protected by the governance provisions that have incorporated into HB 4. The structure of the board of directors, the quality of folk that are working, the subjecting AGDC to the Executive Budget Act, the annual financial reportings and audits, and the whole suite of, what do you just call it, governance elements, and the requirement that this is a public corporation and they must operate in as open and transparent manner as is humanly possible in these circumstances while protecting the proprietary business information they develop on their way to a successful project. With that, Mr. Chairman, again, thank you very kindly for your courtesy. Ask for the money for the purposes of continuity. Allow us to complete the project. And as you hopefully would pass this bill out of your committee, I believe you're passing a bill that has well-structured, very strong governance provisions to assure the people of the state of Alaska that a project only goes forward if it's appropriate and in the best interests of the state. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee.
Thank you, Representative Hawker. Representative Chenault.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Mike Chenault, District 28 on the Kenai Peninsula. My cohort here basically said everything I think needs to be said. Mr. Chairman, I think that the last thing that Alaskans want is to see another project stalled by an act of the legislature. I believe that by fully funding this, we give AGDC the best opportunity to get to a completed, successful open season. My concerns about not fully funding this, Mr. Chairman, would be the legislature would have to come back and meet. And that means either, you know, depending on timing, we would either have to call ourselves back in for a special session, or we would delay the project or delay the final go on a project. You pick which month that they have to bring this project to us and not have the funds. Mr. Chairman, I think it causes uncertainty. And in the gas market, I think uncertainty has been the thing that has killed a number of projects. So, Mr. Chairman, I would ask for the additional funding. I do want to thank the committee members. This is a very integral bill. It has a lot of parts, pieces, as you can well expect as you went through it and listened to Representative Hawker's staff explain it. There's been a lot of thought put into this. There's been a lot of, not just thought, but there's been a lot of work. A lot of gyrations of every, just I would say almost every word in there is there for a reason. And we've spent basically 3 years on the project. We think it's time to go, and I would just ask that committee members support that, and let's actually build the project. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee members.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Representative Chenault, Representative Hawker. I know you both have a lot of time, effort, blood, sweat, and tears invested in this bill, and I appreciate you bring the bill forward to this committee. This time, I'll open it up for any final questions or comments. I did get a note that we are going back on the floor at 5:45. So, but I think we pretty much have asked you everything we wanted to ask, but I want to give the committee one more time or one more opportunity. Okay. You're not moving it, are you? Yeah, we'll I mean, well, okay, go ahead, Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The many of the people who testified earlier this week were concerned that this project and moving it forward would mean the elimination of the possibility of a large pipeline. And I just wonder, Representative Chenault, Representative Hawker, if you might close us on what you believe is before us as a decision and why you believe this project either does or does not preclude that project, and why all of us are trying to bring energy to all of Alaska.
Senator Faircloth, through the chair, I don't believe that it stops any project moving forward. As I think we all know, the governor is intent on the AGEA process. They're working with those organizations and trying to see if they can move a bigger project forward. Certainly this could morph into a bigger project. I think that's what all Alaskans want. You know, I can tell you, Senator Faircloth, that for the last 3 years, I've been called a lot of things just simply because we're trying to move a project forward. One being not a smart guy, because don't I know that a bigger pipeline means more gas? I come from the oil industry. I've probably forgotten more about Obeam than a number of other people around. And so I certainly understand those issues. But we're living under the constraints of legislation that we passed earlier. And this is a way to get gas to Alaskans. And we're not going to get to make that decision on how big that pipe is, as much as we'd like to, unless we want to step up with our checkbook. And I've got a paper here that's one of the plans. Actually, in this piece of paper, that's one of the plans that's out there, that the state of Alaska steps up and pays for the whole project. That's not what we're proposing here. We're proposing to let the buyers and the sellers put together the contracts in order to pay for this project and move it forward. Alaska's benefit is that we finally get to move our natural resource off the slope. We can sit and talk about we want it this big or we want it to go here or there, but as I've stated before, we're not going to make that decision. That decision will be made by the sellers and the buyers, and they'll make those determinations. But to get to that, you've got to have a project on the table. We've heard that there are countries that would love to buy our gas. I certainly believe that that is true. I've been to Taiwan. They would love to have an opportunity to buy our gas. One will be at what price? But they're not going to commit to a project that they don't know what it's going to cost them. And to get to that cost, you've got to go through a process, and that's a process of getting a project on the table. So, you know, we can talk and hope and pray, and I think all of us have done that over time. But until we make the step forward, until we get to an open season, until we see if we can put buyers and sellers together and make that 30-year commitment for a multi-billion-dollar pipeline, it's talk, Senator Faircloth. So I don't know if I answered your question in all reality, but, you know, my hope is that it does get bigger.
Representative Hawker.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Senator Faircloth. Likewise, this has been a co-sponsored project, and Representative Chenault and myself, anybody that would look at us, know we both view the world with a different life experience, and we bring a little different shade to our answers, but we still say the same thing, and that is that there is nothing in House Bill 4 that eliminates or compromises the possibility of a much larger capacity pipeline than is being contemplated in the base case of HB 4. And Senator Faircloth, you have asked it's a brilliant question, because it gets right down to the meat of the difference between what House Bill 4 really does and how its opponents are characterizing it. And I might prefer to use the word mischaracterizing it. HB 4 in its entirety is built around a base case pipeline project that is limited by AGIA. HB 4 in its larger, and I would emphasize, a viable base case project, an economically viable base case project that does not go forward unless it has an underpinning viable financial transaction. But in its larger sense, what HB 4 does is it provides the state of Alaska, the administration, and the people, and by that, the people of the state of Alaska's elected administration, all of the tools that they need, we need, to participate in a larger pipeline project that becomes a reality. In fact, I'd offer there is only one other pipeline project that has any viable opportunity right now of moving forward, and that is the AGIA project. But that's also why we respect this. HB4 is built to move in tandem with the AGIA project and in a manner that at the end of that line, those lines will either converge or one of them will fall away before a pipeline project is ever constructed in this state. But Senator Fairclough, through the chair, we have been waiting how long for that producer-owned project to occur. It hasn't happened. We have great hopes that it can happen. We have great hopes that it comes forward, and AGDC has a role in participating, representing the state's interests in that project. But should it not, we have the base case to fall back onto that is compliant with the determination that was made by a former legislature to grant that exclusive right to the vast majority of the state's North Slope natural gas for a pipeline to take it somewhere. And I keep reminding folks that that somewhere, we keep hearing about it being overseas. First it was the lower 48, then it was overseas. AGDC is about, and HB 4 is about, making sure that the people of Alaska get gas. And that's, we start with a backbone. From that backbone that runs to our major population centers, the only limit on what Alaskans can do with that gas for every region of the state is limited only by the vision of Alaskans, their entrepreneurship, and their ability to come forward with an economically viable idea for their region. So, Madam Chair, there is nothing about HB 4 that in any way compromises the possibility of a larger pipe project. And if anything, Madam Chair, it gives the state the ability to assure we actually see, at the end of the day, a right-sized project for the state of Alaska. Thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hawker. Additional questions? Any other committee members' questions? Okay. Seeing none, thank you both. So we'll adjourn for tonight. Tomorrow we'll be taking up House Bill 4 again. As well as House Bill 129, Oil and Gas Exploration Development, House Bill 71, Alaska Regional Economic Assistance Programs, and HJR 6, a task force on unmanned aircraft. Okay, so with that, we're adjourned till tomorrow at 9.